Utna went into Minideka to find Sionji just finishing up his shift, but he was gracious enough to stick around and, further, make an exception to the no breakfast foods after 11 a.m. rule for her. "Your usual?" he inquired as she entered. "If it's really not too late," she replied. Sionji smiled slightly. "One absolute breakfast apocalypse and toast," he said, and turned to the grill, leaving her to give him a weird look in momentary silence. "So, Tenjo," he said conversationally as he put the sausage patty and Canadian bacon slices onto the grill, "what are you and your partner in crime up to now that we've some time off?" "Kate wants to break in her new driver's license," Utna told him, "so we're going to Toronto." Sionji finished cracking the eggs, then turned, cocking an eyebrow. "I've heard of this Toronto place before," he said. "You and the others went there last fall. I'm told you had quite a time." "I don't suppose..." "No, never mind. You wouldn't want me tagging along." Utna looked thoughtful. "Well, I don't know that it'd be that bad," she said with exaggerated consideration. "As long as you behaved yourself," she added. "I'd have to ask Kate, though. It's her trip." Sionji shook his head. "No, really. I spoke before I thought. It was rude of me to invite myself like that." "Sionji," said Utna dangerously, putting her hands on her hips, "do me a favor and don't turn passive-aggressive. That kind of thing really drives me crazy." Sionji looked back at her over his shoulder and said seriously, "Sorry." "Do you actually want to go?" Utna pressed. "Well, yes," said Sionji. "It sounds interesting. Today's my last day of work before classes start again, and I'd like to see more of this world." He shrugged, smiling sardonically, and went wryly on, "And I don't find your company as tiresome as I once did." Utna chuckled. "That makes two of us," she replied, then shook her head in wonder. "Quite surreal," Sionji agreed. "I'll ask Kate," said Utna as she paid for it, accepted her breakfast, "but no promises." He nodded. "I understand, and thank you." Utna carried her tray out to wedge booth number 1, sat down, and waited for Kate to come back from wherever she'd wandered off to. She returned from around the corner, where she'd used one of the pair of terminals installed in a little glassed-in closet by the Institute Road entrance, to check her mail and reconfirm their motel reservations, waved, and went into Minideka to get her own lunch. When she returned, bearing a tray with a tech burger, fries, and a Coke, Utna asked her, "Did he ask you?"
"Ask me what?" Kate replied, seating herself.
"Guess not," Utna replied. She took a drink of her own Coke and then said, "Sionji wants to go to Toronto. I told him it was up to you."
"Oh."
Kate had a fry and considered this.
You don't mind?
"Nah," said Utna. "He's really changed. I actually..." "How weird does it feel to say this?" "Like the guy now. But I didn't know how you'd feel about it."
Kate thought it over for a moment, then smiled.
"Fine with me," she said. "If he gets out of line, we can have Dorothy break his arm."
"Say, that's a thought," Utna mused.
She polished off the last of her omelet and asked, "Have you found Dorothy yet?"
"I wasn't aware," said our Dorothy calmly, "that I was missing."
"Ah, there you are," Kate said. "How'd you like to go to Toronto with us?"
"All right," Dorothy replied. "What will we do there?"
"Well," said Utna, scratching at the back of her neck, "we, sort of figured we'd sort that out when we get there. You know, play it by ear."
"Ah," said Dorothy, nodding. "Improvisation does seem to be your strong suit," she went on, deadpan.
Thanks, said Utina, grinning sheepishly.
Sionji's relief arrived at noon, just as Caitlin was finishing her lunch. A few moments later, the tall, green-haired young man emerged from mini-deka, his apron slung over his shoulder. He saw them sitting together in the booth, and headed toward it, smiling the smile of a man who has just been released from an unpleasant duty for 2 weeks.
"Okay, Sionji, you can come along," Utina told him, as if granting a sizable favor. "But behave yourself, or Dorothy will have to hurt you."
Dorothy gave her a curious look, but said nothing. He squared himself, bowed, and said with an almost ponderous mock seriousness, "I shall be the soul of discretion."
"Where are you going?" Utina asked Kate as the brown-haired girl got to her feet and made to leave the booth.
"We'll need another room," she replied. Then she smiled slightly at Sionji and added, "I'm a trusting soul, but there are limits."
Indeed, said Sionji, going ever so faintly pink, as Kate went past him and around the corner to use one of the Wedge Gweepery terminals again.
"Better go get your stuff," said Utina. "We're leaving as soon as we get everything lined up."
"So soon?" he inquired, raising an eyebrow. Then he shrugged and answered his own question with another. "Why wait? All right, I'll be back here in a few minutes."
"I should prepare as well," said Dorothy as Sionji went. "We'll be gone for a week?"
"Maybe 8 days," Utina replied, nodding. "I won't need my maintenance bay then," Dorothy said. "I'll just pack the emergency kit and a few other things."
As Dorothy left the wedge, Utina got up, put her tray and Kate's on top of one of the trash containers, then went and stood looking out of the front windows of the wedge across the quad. While she stood there looking, an unfamiliar car entered the quad ring road between Daniels and Riley Halls, rounded the quad past Alumni Gym and Harrington Auditorium, and pulled into a parking space in front of the wedge. It was a type Utina hadn't seen before, long, sleek, and square. It looked vaguely similar to Corwin Ravenhair's car, but slightly smaller. Then again, she'd never seen a car bigger than Corwin's antique Griffin limousine, and with cleaner, plainer lines and no fins. It was a beautiful glossy black with a lot of brightly polished chrome, bumpers, forward-leaning grille, bezels around its 4 circular headlights and 6 little round taillights, little 3-bladed spinners on the wheel covers, and a pointed chrome stripe running from stem to stern along a line with the gleaming thumb-button door handles. The windshield was wide and curved, rimmed entirely in chrome, but the back window was tiny. Utina realized as the car pulled into the parking space that this was because it was a convertible. And, she noticed with a curious, it had Avalon County license plates. A moment later, the door opened, and Corwin Ravenhair got out.
"Hey," said Utina, and she went out through the airlock, jumped down the short stairs to the sidewalk, and trotted across the street to meet him.
"What are you doing here?" she asked. "Not that I mind. New car?"
"Sort of," said Corwin as he willingly absorbed the impact of her welcoming hug.
"It's a surprise," Nall added from his shoulder, then bent his head to receive the scritching that was his due.
"You like it?" Corwin inquired.
"It's beautiful," Utina replied as she disengaged from both of them to a conversational distance.
"What is it?"
"You'll find out in a minute," he said with an it's-a-secret grin. "Kate around?"
"Sure, she's inside."
As they went inside, Utina told him about their semi-planned Toronto trip, and for some reason the news made his grin get even wider. A moment later, Kate came around the corner from the Gweepery, saw Corwin, and paused, smiling. Corwin plunged his hand into his pants pocket, removed it again, and said, "Hey, Kate, think fast." There was a shimmery jingling noise as a small bundle of metallic objects arced between the two siblings,
Then Kate snapped up her hand and caught it almost unconsciously. She glanced quizzically at it, then up to Corwin, and he smiled even wider, went to her side, and squired her out to the quad. "Caitlin," he said, indicating the black and red car with a sweep of his hand. "From Dad, Mom, me, your mom, and all the gang back home, happy birthday." "A little early," Nall added. Utna understood what he meant by that. Caitlin's birthday was a bit less than 3 weeks away, but that was during the first week of D-term. Apparently her father had thought, and rightly so, in Utna's opinion, that it would be a shame to wait for the correct date and deny her the opportunity to use her gift during spring break in the process. A father who balanced the sentimental against the practical with such skill was a man to be cherished, she thought, a smile crossing her face as she remembered the birthday party Kate's dad had thrown for her back in December when she'd turned 15. Kate looked at Corwin with an expression of disbelief, then slowly walked around the car, taking it in from all angles. "This is real," she finally said to her brother, looking a trifle skeptical. "Not an inflatable mock-up or something. Corwin looked hurt. "Would we toy with your emotions that way?" "Dad might," Nall said. "He has weird ideas about gift-giving sometimes." "Well, yeah, okay," Corwin acknowledged. "But Mom and Kay would never have stood for it." He slapped a palm down on the hood of the car, producing a most satisfactory thump. "It's real, all right." Kate took the keys out of her pocket and pressed the green button on the little remote control that accompanied them. With a quiet blip of the horn, the car's two doors unlocked. She opened the driver's door, slid behind the wheel, and sat, examining the deceptively simple-looking retro controls. There was an envelope taped to one of the radio knobs. She peeled it off and opened it, took out a gaily colored holiday card, then made a small, startled noise as something smaller inside it fell into her lap when she opened it. Utna leaned down in the driver's open door, interested. Corwin waited for Nall's inevitable desertion, then came around to the passenger side and leaned down to look in from the other side, grinning broadly. The car's interior was done up in chrome and blood-red metal and leather, and the air was perfumed with the very distinctive scent of a classic automobile. "What's in the card?" Utna asked. "Parking permit from school," Kate replied, holding it up. "I guess it's more of Miss Montaigne's way of apologizing for the room situation." She grinned. "Not that I need an apology, but I'll take it." Utna grinned in return. Kate adjusted her seat a little, settled back with her hands on the wheel, and smiled. She closed her eyes, took a deep breath through her nose, let it out again, and then opened her eyes and beamed at her brother. She got out of the car, closed the door behind her, and went around the back, admiring the clean chrome script of the name badge, Impala SS, and the neat lines of the rear quarter as she did so. Corwin straightened and turned as she came to his arms. Kate rounded the rear of the car, took two bounding steps, and threw her arms around Corwin, hugging him tightly. He smiled and gave it back, and when she let him loose and stepped back, she had tears on her face and couldn't frame her thanks intelligibly. "It's okay," said Corwin, grinning and drawing her back in. "I know what you're trying to say. Happy birthday, Kate." They separated at length, a little sniffly but smiling, and Corwin said, "So I hear you've already got a road trip planned." "Yeah," said Kate, wiping at her eyes. "We're going back to Toronto for the week." "Toronto? For a week? Sweet!" Nall declared. "Hey, Corwin, can you get along without me for a week?" Corwin shot the dragon a look. "Kidding! Kidding!" Nall insisted. "I've got classes too, you know," he added. "You go to classes?" Utna asked him, surprised. "Sure," Nall told her. "A dragon's got to learn somehow," he went on, "and it beats the schools in Alfheim, believe me." She might have asked him to elaborate on that a little, but Corwin was asking, "So when are you leaving?"
"As soon as we can pull everything together," Utrin replied. "Good thing you caught us when you did. Another few minutes and we'd have been trying to figure out a way up to the airport to rent a car."
"Well," said Corwin, patting the Impala's fender, "you don't have to worry about that anymore."
"No, I guess not," said Kate, smiling.
"Hey, Corwin!"
came a familiar voice. The foursome turned to see Azalin trotting toward them, with Miki Kaworu following behind at a more sedate pace. Miki still looked about half asleep, his hair mussed, and the half or so of his uniform that he was actually wearing rumpled. Utrina was a bit tickled by this sight. She couldn't remember ever having seen Miki disheveled before. She resisted an urge to go nudge him with her elbow and look sly at him. Azalin and Miki duly admired Kate's new car, and Corwin finally mentioned what it was, a 1962 Chevrolet Impala Supersport. The name didn't mean much to Utrina, but the year stuck in her mind. For the next few moments she attempted, without much success, to get her head around the idea that the automobile she was leaning against had been manufactured 427 years before her birth. That was older than the school. Older than the reconstituted city of Worcester. "Most of it's not authentic anymore, you understand," Corwin added with a slightly apologetic tone. "There wasn't much left when we found it, so we restored for durability and utility rather than authenticity. Everything's built to the expert spec for a Type 1 field agent vehicle." He rapped on the hood with his knuckles. "Composite reinforced body panels with pyroclastic lamination, Class B cluster windows, climate management field." Kate and Corwin ranged around the car, talking in animated tones about various technical aspects of its construction that made no sense to the other three, who tuned it out.
Where was Kyuichi heading in such a hurry? Azalin wondered.
Utena had to stop and think for a second before she realized the Dentrovian was talking about Sionji. Azalin was the only one who ever called him by his first name.
"Getting his stuff," Utena replied. "Kate decided he could come to Toronto with us if he promised to be a good boy."
Azalin was momentarily distracted by the click and whir of the Impala's top starting to retract. Then she said, "Well, that's nice. It'll be good for him to get away for a while and have some fun." She nudged Miki with her elbow. "You should go too," she said. He finished knotting his tie, then turned to her, blinking. "But what about..."
"Exactly why I think you ought to go," Azalin replied with a grin. "It's a time for thinking of oneself. Step back and contemplate. Seek new experiences."
"Just be careful,"
she went on, leaning over in a comically public aside.
"The Canadians are awfully touchy about that kind of stuff."
He reddened slightly. Utina snickered, which got a look from him that made her almost break outright.
"Well, all right," said Miki. "If Utina and Caitlin don't mind."
Utina grinned, turned, and called, "Hey, Kate!" Caitlin's head emerged from behind the car's upraised hood.
"Hmm?"
"Can the boy genius come with? Azalin wants him out of her hair for a few days."
"That's not..." Azalin started, but Utina gave her a wink, and she cut off the protest with a smile.
"Well," said Kate, "I don't see why not. How fast can you pack for a week?"
Miki smiled, triggered his stopwatch, turned, and dashed off toward Galaxy House. Azalin watched him go with a satisfied expression, then turned to Utina and grinned.
"He's so spontaneous," she said, and Utina gave up and broke.
15 minutes later, the travelers were gathered in the wedge, double-checking their belongings and their travel plan, such as it was. Appreciative noises were being made over Kate's new, old car, and those embarking on the adventure were suitably envied. Presently, the five intrepid voyagers loaded their cargo.
Do you need a ride to this spaceport?"
Kate asked Corwin, as the others arranged themselves for the trip.
"Sure, if it's not too much trouble. Otherwise, I can walk. It's a nice day.
Make you walk after you brought me this?
Kate asked, indicating the Impala with a sweep of her arm.
Don't be stupid.
Hey, Utna, budge up, she went on. Utna obligingly slid over a bit toward the middle of the front bench seat. She couldn't get all the way into the center without blocking the gear shift lever, but between the two of them, she and Corwin figured out an arrangement that was comfortable enough and still allowed Caitlin to drive.
Have a good trip,
Mia Ausa called as Kate backed the Impala out of its parking space.
And a safe flight home, Corwin,
Azalin added. Corwin turned to wave, and as he did so, he caught sight of Juri Arisugawa, standing back near the steps down from the wedge, where she'd taken her leave of her old schoolmates and Dorothy a few moments earlier. She was giving him the oddest look. Not a glare like the ones he'd caught her tossing his way over the course of the previous weekend. Rather a very strange expression, hard to read. He finally decided that it was, improbable as it seemed, a combination of annoyance, wistfulness, and... what? Hope, maybe? It was weird, anyway, and so unexpected under the circumstances that he faltered briefly in his calls of farewell.
What's the matter? Utrin inquired.
Nothing, he replied, shaking his head. He could see from Nall's expression that he knew better, but the dragon kept silent. As the remaining duelists stood and watched their officers roar off into the sunset, Mia turned to Azalin and said quietly, so the others wouldn't hear as they dispersed,
Jihan Nachayar is Tuesday, isn't it?
Azalin looked briefly startled, then recovered and replied,
Yes? Why do you ask?
Mia looked slightly embarrassed.
I've read a good deal about Dantrovian animism, she finally said, but never met anyone who practiced it before. I remember reading that Jihan Nachayar was a day dedicated to a search for identity.
She looked slightly more self-conscious still as she went on.
I think I could probably find some benefit in something like that right about now.
Azalin gave her a thoughtful look. She mused. Then, brightening, she said, Well, why don't we go someplace quiet and talk about it? Juri Arisugawa sat on the short concrete wall next to the stairs down from the wedge to the sidewalk and watched the two of them walk across the quad. She seemed lost in thought, frowning absently into the middle distance, when Skaya emerged from the wedge, descended the stairs, and paused, noting her.
"Good day to you, Miss Arisugawa," he remarked, causing her to jolt slightly as she came back to herself. Diplomatically, he ignored it and went on, "You seem to be at a bit of a loose end. Can I offer you some opposition? I know when I get into such a mood, I always feel better with steel to cross."
Juri scanned the Scrang's pteranodon face for a moment, then nodded.
"I think I'd like that," she said, and she jumped down from the wall to accompany Skye to Alden Hall.
Corwin Ravenhair guided Dagger Disc away from Earth, watching it shrink in the rearview display, then called for metaspace clearance.
Roger, Echo 6650, came the voice of Earth Force Jump Gate Control. You are cleared on Gate 11. Clear skies, Earth Force out. Ahead of him, the staging flashes marched down the four sides of the jump gate, then collided in the center, and the rippling distortion disk of the jump point itself spiraled out of the nothingness into existence. Corwin guided Dagger Disk into the lane, locked her navigational receiver onto the Zeta Cygni beacon signal, and punched the throttles open. The gate surged, the point collapsed behind him, and he was surrounded by the brooding scarlet maelstrom of metaspace. Corwin leaned back in his seat, took off his comset earpiece, and sighed deeply.
"You know, Nall," he said, "I don't think I get that redhead at all."
"Yeah," said Nall, by which he meant, "No, me neither."
Oh, well, Corwin said, getting up from his seat. At least she isn't glaring at me anymore. Still, what the hell was that about? Search me, said Nall. We got any of that tuna fish left? This concludes Symphony of the Sword on Tract, A Question of Faith. The Symphony will return.